Chapter 39. Palembang, Sumatra, Indonesia. The tires crunched on gravel as Sam pulled the car off the road and coasted to a stop beneath the boughs of a kapok tree. A steady stream of compact cars and scooters whizzed past Sam's door, honking and swerving as though trying to beat a checkered flag. "Okay, you win," Sam said to Remy. "But before I risk my life and step into this traffic to ask for directions, let me see the map one more time." While, like most men, Sam prided himself on being equipped with a supernatural internal compass that kept him from ever being lost, he'd also learned to concede those rare times when that compass seemed to be in temporary disrepair. Now was one of those times. Trying to conceal her smile, Remy handed him the map and sat quietly while Sam studied it. "It's gotta be around here somewhere." "I'm sure it is." As was the case with many of Sam and Remy's revelations since finding the Shenandoah's bell buried in the sand off Zanzibar, Winston Blaylock had, as the saying went, been there and done that. In this case, one of the latitude and longitude points they'd deciphered from his dot grid system happened to fall where Javier Orizaga, S.J., had spent the final years of his life. It was no coincidence, they knew. Still, there were many questions unanswered. Having spent years hunting for the origin of his great green-jeweled bird and discovering along the way the true story of the Aztec Empire, had Blaylock heard of Orizaga's codex and come here looking for a copy? Or had he found the codex elsewhere and deduced the location the same way Sam and Remy had? Similarly, what had brought Orizaga here? A quest for treasure, or for the history of a people whose destruction he witnessed? An hour after they'd ended their video conference meeting with Professor Didel, he'd called back with the name of the village Orizaga had called home the last 2 decades of his life, Palembang, Sumatra. While Palembang, the Venice of the East, might have been considered just a hamlet during the 16th century, today it was not only the oldest city in Indonesia, dating back to the 7th century, but also the biggest in southern Sumatra, boasting a population of 1.5 million. Neither Sam nor Remy had any grand ideas about what, if anything, of value they'd find by investigating Orizaga's adopted homeland. However, all the hoops they'd jumped through since Zanzibar seemed to be leading them in one direction. Blaylock's quest, his journal, the maps, the codex, Orizaga himself, and now the lab report, all of it pointed toward an unknown location in Indonesia. "It would have made our lives so much easier if Orizaga had left an address," Sam said. "It's a bit inconsiderate, really." "I'm sure if he'd known we were coming, he would have," Remy replied. "Did the woman at the last place say the house was red or green?" "Green." Since arriving in Palembang the previous day, they'd visited 6 local museums or historians said to specialize in the pre-Dutch colonial period of the city's history. So far, none of the curators had heard of Orizaga, and each one had suggested Sam and Remy go to the city's administrative building and peruse centuries' worth of microfiche newspapers for any mention of their friend. Sam traced his finger along the map, occasionally ducking his head so he could see the nearby street signs through the windshield. He folded the map and handed it back to Remy with a confident smile. "I know where I went wrong." "In general, or with the directions?" "Funny lady." Sam put the car in gear, waited for a gap in traffic, then veered out and accelerated. 20 minutes of winding down back streets brought them to an industrial park filled with warehouses. Behind this, they were surprised to find a quiet, tree-lined residential cul-de-sac. The houses were small and old, but well-kept. At the end of the circle, Sam pulled to a stop before what could have passed for a ranch-style house in any town, USA. Kelly green, with brown shutters and a white picket fence, half hidden by red flowering vines. They walked up the path, mounted the porch steps, and knocked on the front door. They heard the click of footfalls on wood. The door opened to reveal a mid-50s white man in crisp khaki pants and a button-down white shirt. "Yes, Good afternoon, he said with an Oxford accent. We're looking for the Sukhasari house, Remy said.
You have found it, madam. How can I help you?
We're looking for someone, a monk, who may or may not have lived in this area in the 16th century.
Oh, well, is that all? I thought you'd come to try to sell me a vacuum or some pots and pans, the man said with a wry smile. Please, come in.
He stepped back to let them into the foyer.
My name is Robert Marcotte.
Sam and Remy Fargo.
Follow me. I'll make some tea, and then tell you everything I know about Indonesia in the 15th century.
Pardon me for saying this, Remy said, but you don't seem surprised by our question.
I'm not. Here, come sit down. I'll explain.
He ushered them into a study enclosed by floor-to-ceiling bookcases. The floor was covered with a Persian rug. On top of it were a few rattan furniture pieces around a coffee table. Sam and Remy sat on the sofa.
I'll be just a moment, Marcotte said, then disappeared through a side door. They heard the clinking of china, then a pot whistling. He came back in with the tea service, filled their cups, then sat down across from them.
Who pointed you in my direction? Marcotte asked.
A woman named Ratsami.
Lovely woman. Knows nothing about Sumatran history prior to the 20th century. She was under the impression this was a museum.
A bit of a language gap, I'm afraid. Historian versus museum. While the official language here is Indonesian, dialects abound. I gave up trying to correct people. 10 years ago, I wrote a book on Christianity in Indonesia. Evidently, it turned me into a museum.
Marcotte got up, walked to a nearby shelf, retrieved a book, and handed it to Remy. God in Java, she read.
It could be worse. Almost was. My publisher wanted to call it Jesus in Java.
Sam chuckled.
You chose wisely. I would have been inundated with people wanting to know the religious significance of coffee. It would have been a nightmare. At any rate, I came here to research the book, fell in love with the place, and stayed. That was 15 years ago. You're looking for a monk, you said?
Yes, a man named Javier Orizaga, a Jesuit. He would have arrived here in the late 1520s, probably...
Ah, Orizaga, 1528, Marcotte said. He lived about 2 miles east of here, in fact. Of course, the hut is no longer there. I think it's a burger restaurant now.
What can you tell us about him? Asked Remy.
What do you want to know? How much time do you have? Sam countered.
Unlimited quantities.
Then tell us everything. You're going to be disappointed. He was an interesting man, and he worked hard to help the locals, but he was just one of thousands of missionaries that came here over the last half millennium. He opened a Bible school, helped at local hospitals, and spent a lot of time in rural villages trying to save souls.
Have you ever heard of the Orizaga Codex? Sam asked.
Marcotte narrowed his eyes. No, but based on the name, I somehow think I should have. Am I about to be terribly embarrassed?
I don't see why, Remy said.
She gave Marcotte the short version of the Codex's history, leaving out the specifics about its content or origin.
Marcotte smiled. Fascinating.
Did this codex ingratiate him with the church, or was it the opposite?
The opposite.
Then it was sympathetic to the Aztecs. I wish I had known all this about him. I might have devoted a whole chapter to him. There was one interesting story, but it didn't really fit into the book, so I left it out. He died in 1556, 28 years after arriving here. Or at least, that's when he was last seen.
I don't understand, Remy asked.
The story goes that in November of that year, Orizaga announced to his followers and colleagues that he believed he'd discovered a sacred place in the jungle. He didn't say where exactly, and that he was going to find the...
What was it?
Marcotte paused, tapping his index finger on his lower lip.
Oh, yes.
He called it the Seven Caves, or World of the Seven Caves, something along those lines. He walked into the jungle and never came back. From what I understand, Orizaga was considered a bit of a nut. There's a lot of that going around, Sam said. So he walked into the jungle and just vanished. Marcotte nodded. Never seen again. I realize it sounds very dramatic, but even today disappearances aren't uncommon. 500 years ago it was probably a daily event. The jungles here are unforgiving, even for someone as well-traveled as Orizaga. Marcotte paused and smiled ruefully. Talking about the man, I find myself really wishing I'd devoted at least a few pages in the book to his story. Oh, well. I don't suppose you still have your primary source material on him, do you? Asked Remy. No, I'm afraid not. But I can do better than that. I can take you to my source. Providing he's still alive, that is. They followed Marcotte in his 20-year-old BMW to another residential area in Palembang's Plaju district. Here the roads were dirt, the houses no larger than 600 square feet, with corrugated tin roofs, unpainted plankwood exteriors, and mosquito netting windows. Beside almost every structure was a tiny vegetable garden and pens containing either chickens or goats. Marcotte pulled to a stop before one of the houses. Sam and Remy did the same and got out. Marcotte said, "He doesn't speak English, and he's in his 90s, so be prepared." "Who are we meeting?" "Apologies. Dumadi Orizaga. Before he died, Javier had 10 children with a local woman. Dumadi is a direct descendant of Orizaga."
"I thought he was a Jesuit," said Remy.
"He was, but at some point he renounced his vows. Including celibacy, obviously." "Maybe because of his ordeal with the church," Sam offered. They followed Marcotte up the path to a screen door made of 2x4s and threadbare mosquito netting. After Marcotte's fourth fist rap on the jam, an old man in a white tank top shuffled into view. He was barely over 5 feet tall, and his face bore mostly Indonesian features, with touches of Spanish thrown in. Marcotte said something to Dumadi in Indonesian or one of its dialects. The old man smiled and nodded and pushed open the door. The three of them stepped inside. The interior of the home was divided into thirds, a 20-by-20-foot sitting area with 4 plastic lawn chairs and a cardboard box coffee table, and 2 side rooms, one a bedroom-bathroom, the other a kitchen. Dumadi gestured for everyone to sit. Translating as he went, Marcotte introduced Sam and Remy, then explained that they'd come to Palembang to learn more about Orizaga. Dumadi said something. "He wants to know why you're interested in him," Marcotte replied. "They're very guarded about their family here, even after 500 years. Ancestral veneration is a deeply ingrained tradition for Indonesians." Sam and Remy looked at each other. Never imagining they would find descendants of Orizaga, they hadn't discussed how to explain their mission. "Let's tell him the truth," Sam said. "If the codex belongs to anyone, it's him." Remy nodded, reached into her carry-all, and withdrew a manila envelope. She flipped through the photos and papers inside, then withdrew the scan of the codex. She handed it across to Dumadi. Sam said to Marcotte, "Tell him we think this belonged to Orizaga, and that we believe it has something to do with why he came here in the first place." Marcotte translated. Staring at the scan in his hands, Dumadi nodded, but Sam and Remy could tell the old man had barely heard Marcotte. The silence dragged out. Finally, Marcotte said something else to Dumadi, who laid the scan on the cardboard box, climbed to his feet, and shuffled off into the bedroom. He emerged a moment later carrying a frame. He stopped before Remy and handed it to her. Drawn in stylized calligraphy, with filigreed edges and intricate swirls and flourishes, the original was far removed from the photo, but for Sam and Remy there was no mistaking what they were seeing. The pictomap from Orizaga's codex. Dumadi pointed at the framed photo, then at the scan,
and said something to Marcotte, who translated. He doesn't recognize the bottom portion, but the top portion's been passed down through his family for centuries. Why? Asked Sam. Marcotte asked, listened to Damati's response, then said, It's the Orizaga family coat of arms. Does he know what it means?
No.
No one ever talked about what it might mean.
No,
Marcotte replied. He says it's always been part of the family. He assumes it was important to Orizaga, and that's good enough for him. Sam flipped through Remy's manila envelope and withdrew Wendy's version of the Quetzalcoatl bird from the Chickamauztalk illustration. He handed it to Damati. Does that mean anything to him? Marcotte asked, listened. He smiled and replied, Which part? The ugly snake or the bird? The bird. Damati sat back down with a groan, then replied. It has no particular meaning to him, Marcotte said. It's just a bird. He's seen them in zoos.
Here?
Remy asked. He doesn't remember where exactly. He saw one when he was a child. His father called it a helmet bird because of the bulge on the back of its head. Sam opened his mouth to speak, hesitated, then said, What is it? What's it called?
A maleo.
Damati says he recalls they're much prettier than your drawing. Medium-sized, black back, white breast, yellow skin around the eyes, and an orangish beak. Sort of like a colorful chicken. Damati said something to Marcotte, who translated. He wants to know if this drawing has anything to do with Orizaga. It does, said Sam. It reminds him of a story about Orizaga. Would you like to hear it?
Yes, please, Remy replied.
Like most of their family stories, the details may have changed over time, but the gist of it is this. Near the end of his life, Orizaga was known by most of the people in Palembang, and they were fond of him. They were also sure he was possessed by a mischievous spirit. Why? Asked Sam. Marcotte listened. It's similar to what I told you back at my home. He wandered the jungles a lot, talking about caves and gods, and that he'd come here to find the home of the gods. You get the idea. No one was afraid of Orizaga. They suspected this mischievous spirit was having fun with a poor old man. The day Orizaga disappeared, he announced to everyone that he was again setting out to find his god caves, and that he would know the place when he found a hatchery of great birds.